Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome, Thomas.
Hi.
Welcome to the podcast. So we have my friend, Ben's friend, Thomas Frank here. He's staying with us today. He's joining us for the podcast. And because of him, I should let you all know that the video quality is going to surge next week. He talked us into the largest the largest equipment purchase we've ever made.
It's going to be a good one.
Yeah. We're about to look like documentary quality out here. So Thomas is a productivity guy, tech wizard. And he sold us some Sony, apparently Sony employee. sold us $5,000.
The funny thing is,
I
do not shoot on Sony.
Yeah.
All Canon. But you guys wanted to go long, so.
We're doing it.
Yeah. Thomas, Charlie and I are an 80-20 guys through and through. Thomas is a 100-100 guy. He likes to do everything he can to make it as good as physically possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, should we hop in?
Do your thing.
I had a question. So, for people who don't know you, Thomas, I guess give yourself a little introduction. And also, this is something, as we were thinking about the podcast, I realized I don't know. Why did you start your YouTube channel? And how long ago was that? And how long did it take before you were actually full-time on it?
Okay, so it's like four questions.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Thomas. And, okay, so what was the first question? Who am I?
Just give a little thing about yourself so people know who don't know who you are. So
yeah, I mean, context. At this point, my name is Thomas Frank. I'm 30 years old, and I make videos and blog posts, and I guess I did do podcast episodes, and I kind of focus on how to help people become more productive and more capable. Like you said, I'm a 100-100 person. I like to figure out the best way to do everything, so just, I don't know, the nerd in me. And typically what I focus on is digital productivity, organization, habits, things like that.
Yeah.
I got my start doing content on how to become a better college student and get better grades because I was in college when I started my blog. So this was 2010. Great recession, all that happened. My dad got laid off. I'm like, okay, world is going to be as the most competitive thing ever. I have to go to college. I have to get all A's. I have to do every single club. Otherwise I will never get a job. That was what was in my brain as a high school student. So I read every single college prep book that my library had, went to college, and then even got a job giving like campus tours and answering questions. So I kind of like had pre-selected myself to become an advice blogger.
Got it. Nice.
And I was reading some other ones like, you know, Life Hacker, things like that. There was one called Hack College. And at the end of my freshman year, they had come up with this application because they were kicking their founders out. Like, our founders are graduating. They're not students anymore. They can't write for us. So we need new students and new blood. And I applied and promptly got rejected. So, nice. But I had written this post for them that they weren't going to publish now. And I'm like, well, I don't want this to go to waste. So I'm just going to make my own website.
Wow.
And yeah.
Do you ever regret that you own 100% of the revenue you create instead of having given it all to those guys instead?
You know what? I often think, like, how amazing would my life be if I had just written for them for 4 years and then been given the
and then been fired?
Would have been so great.
That's a good lesson.
Yeah, dude. At one point, they sold the site. This was like, I don't know, 2015 or something. And then the URL has changed. And it's like, it's basically history.
Yeah. So when you first published that, did you think you were going to write more? Were you just like, if this gets good reception, I'll write more? Like,
yeah, I thought I was going to write more.
Yeah.
I had a blog already. It was just like almost a journal. And I had been building websites since I was 12 years old.
Did you ever have imposter syndrome or a fear that, like, why should I write this? I'm a freshman. No?
No.
Interesting. Because that's something a lot of people struggle with?
If I have a superpower, it's no imposter syndrome, because I understand that the person I was a week ago is less capable than the person I am now. So me now can teach me a week ago something new.
That's the same frame that I had when I was doing it, which is people say like you're a charisma expert. And I don't hope I've never used those words. that's never been my perspective on myself. It was just that I know more than I used to. And there are people that are like me a week ago, a year ago, 3 years ago. And so I don't need to be the greatest in the world to have something valuable to say, sell, talk about, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think that I have the same kind of mindset on it. I never describe myself as a productivity expert. I will be over the moon if other people use that term. No, I'm never going to correct them, but if I describe myself, it's I'm a productivity nerd, or I'm just like passionate about Notion or whatever it is. I'm not an expert. I just like to learn.
I think honestly, we might have put it on a React video. I think our editor or our ops manager might have titled you
Charisma Expert Reacts.
Yeah. So we might, as that's the funny,
that video
you
too.
May not have ever called yourself that, but Charisma on Command has
tacitly signed off on it. I am in fact a charisma expert. I accept.
That's the mantle you accept to do React videos.
Yeah.
So when did you know that you were going to go full time on this? When did you go, you know what? I'm not going to get another job. I'm not going to start another business. I'm all in on this.
It was definitely one of those boiling frog kind of situations.
Okay.
There was never like it's time to quit my job and take the plunge. Because, so I went into college knowing, in quotes for the listeners, what I wanted to do. I had my major picked out before I even started my first classes. And I was like, I'm going to be the dude like Tank in the Matrix who has all the computer screens. And I'm going to be running the whole network for some giant corporation someday. And I got my first internship after my junior year basically doing that, and realized, oh wait, this is like not a cool spaceship that I'm going to sit in. It's a gray cubicle.
Yeah.
And I basically have to just like go through three different bosses before I can do anything. And it's super boring. And the other thing I realized, and this is why I tell people they need to go get work experience as soon as possible, is there's like aspects to work that you would never understand you don't like until you get into it and try it. So you ask people what they want to do for a living, and they'll think of a job. Like, I want to be an IT manager, or I want to be a YouTuber. What I think is more important is what is the kind of work you want to do? Do you want to work with people? Mm-hmm. Do you want to be creative? Do you want to build new things? Or do you want to maintain something and basically keep it running and keep it singing? I learned that I hate maintaining things, and I love building new things. So that internship taught me
I feel that.
Mm-hmm. That internship taught me, okay, no, you can't work in, like, at least not in infrastructural IT, because that's all maintaining crap. You could get into systems building if you wanted to, but I had started blogging around the same time, and I realized I like to write, and I might want to just try this out.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a progression. Can I get a blog that gets traffic? Okay. Can I get a side income? And then at some point in my senior year, the goal was, can I pay off my student loans before I graduate with this blog?
Before you graduated?
Yeah.
Did you?
Now, I didn't have like six-figure student debt. It was 15K. So, you know, not crazy, but I did pay off my student loans like 6 months before graduation.
Nice.
Good for you, man. I paid mine off after I turned 30.
Did you?
That was fast. You know what I mean? Like, that was faster than anticipated. I went on a 10-year payback plan, and it gutted me every month. It was $1,100 a month. Mm-hmm. I was living in a 9-person Victorian home in the basement. Jeez. Yeah, dude, it was crazy. And a quarter or more of every paycheck was just straight to student loans.
Yeah.
And the plan was 10 years, and luckily Charisma on Command did well enough that I didn't like 8.
You just kill it. Yep.
Something. I was, please go away. Haunted me, man. Those things were awful. My biggest expense on any given month, every single month.
It's weird because I have debt now, and it's like I have a mortgage, whatever.
Can I ask you? Sorry, it's topical. How do you feel about student loan forgiveness? Forgiveness.
So for context, I took a political affiliation test in high school, and I think it like sorted me into Democrat, but every single question I'm like, well, I could see one way to go this way, but there's another way to go this way. Like, I can't come up with a strong opinion. So what I will say is my strongest opinion is I am not well-versed enough in the macro and microeconomic details to give a really well-informed opinion here. Mm-hmm. What I will say from a gut perspective though is I want life for my children, if I ever have them, or the younger generation to be better than my life is today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from a gut perspective, can we afford to forgive that debt and provide free education? Or like fast forward your head 50 years from now, would you like everyone to get the amount of education they want for free? If your answer is yes, then you should at least be a soft yes on forgiving student debt.
Mm. Well, they're actually not the same thing though, right?
Yeah.
Because my impression is that forgiving student debt doesn't stop new student debt from cropping up.
Right.
And it also doesn't help people who became carpenters to avoid student debt.
Yeah. And it's like, So there's a lot of different angles to the question, too. You have to ask the question, like, okay, after we forgive this, do we continue to let predatory lending happen?
Exactly.
Do we continue to let these overpriced universities have these programs? Do we continue to say, hey, you're 18, make this gigantic business decision to put yourself six figures in debt to get an English degree?
Yeah. My personal bias is that is a lazy way to redistribute wealth. And I think it's probably not the best way to help people, because you exclude anyone who opted out of college because they couldn't afford it. And you also exclude anyone who isn't a student yet because they're 16, but they're going to be.
Yep.
So I think there's probably a better rule that makes systemic change instead of just helping people who currently have student debt.
Yeah.
But
so I'll say, like, my main answer on this is I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally.
The same thing is, like, I launched a product, it's in beta, and I had somebody email me, they're like, hey, I live in a different country, you know, do you have some sort of like pricing scheme for different countries? Mm-hmm. And partly I'm like, well, that sounds good on one angle, but then on the other angle, like, there's a person probably in this state who doesn't have any money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who'd be like, okay, so what do I need to do? Move to that country to get the discount pricing?
Yeah.
So I don't know the way to solve these problems.
Yeah.
Only do it in foreign languages. And then the option is learn the foreign language. Or pay full price. So if you want to get a VPN and learn how to speak Mandarin, you get the Chinese prices.
Yeah, I need to see if I should do this. I guess I'm putting it on the podcast now. What I would love to do is, like, what I sell can be built. So what if I just put out like a 5-hour tutorial? It's like, here you go. You know, pay nothing except for your time.
Yeah.
If you don't have the option to pay money. I like that because I feel like in education, anytime you're paying money, you're just paying for time savings. You're paying for somebody who can sequence the information correctly and steer you clear of mistakes.
Yeah.
Information's out there. Unless it's like, hey, I need you to do supervised dissections of a cadaver or something, like, okay, then there's a material cost.
You could do that on your own. It's going to take time.
I mean, you got to go in the 1800s
your local
did the
cemetery. Yeah. No, I mean, I think well, we've talked about the specifics of this, but that's really what a lot of YouTube channels that have a course are. Mm-hmm. It's like, here's, look, 99% of the stuff, and I say this about our channel all the time, is like, there are things in Charisma University that I haven't talked about the channel, and I feel defensive about them to some degree, because I'm like, this is my secret sauce.
I must save this.
I've shifted my mindset to sharing more of it, because I believe the value of Charisma University is actually not in the necessarily how much secret or hidden information is there, but the sequencing of it. The action orientation of it, the access to a coach. And so it's like, well, I don't have to be so defensive about what I put on YouTube. I can put much more of it on YouTube because it's too hard to go through to a degree. And it's hard to take all of this and implement and know where to start. Mm-hmm. And that's what a course can be good for, so that the information doesn't need to be hidden in that exact way.
Yeah.
So I've moved more in that direction, though. There's probably one or two sacred cows that I'm like, never.
That's the good stuff.
But what's funny is, like, anybody who goes in it could easily just write a blog post, and there's no trapping information. So
I'm going through a course that my lifting coach's company put together. It's called like the Barbell Principles Academy, I believe, through Barbell Logic. And there's a certification they offer. Mm-hmm. And what my coach was telling me is, like, with a certification, none of that information can be proprietary. So, like, if we're talking about biomechanics or anatomy or whatever it is, we aren't going to come up with some term that you can only learn through taking our course. You can go learn it by reading a book at the library and theoretically pass that exam and get the certification, because we can't gatekeep the information required to do a job. And I guess, you know, in this industry, like, you don't need a certification to do a job, though you do often need it to get a job at a gym.
Why would anybody get certified? I'm just curious.
So in the fitness industry, you do need a certification to work at certain gyms, like if you want to be a CrossFit trainer.
Got it. So it's basically CrossFit like that's their outsourced HR thing, which is like, are you good enough to teach? Do you have the certification? You've done the job of this person.
Yeah, at least for the gyms. Mm-hmm. And then, like, there's definitely prestige elements to it. Mm-hmm. Some people in the evidence-based community will get a certification because that allows them to publish in certain journals. Like, there's all sorts of different reasons and incentives people have for it. But at the end of the day, it's signaling value. Mm. You know, it's basically just a badge that says, I know what I'm talking about.
It's a college degree.
It's the same thing as a college degree. Certifications, diplomas, college degrees, like, most of what you're getting there is the signaling value.
What is your take on that? So I have a perhaps overly dismissive take of certification programs. And in fact, like, I look down on them. I spit in their general direction. Like, do you have a take on certifications' value or lack thereof?
Again, my brain goes in a nuanced direction. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of people going, you would spend $90,000 on a college program, but you could spend $200 on my online course. And it's like, okay, you learn some marketing tricks and then you get in there and the material is just absolutely crap. So a lot of people
also
use...
Also true of college degrees.
This is somewhat true. I'll say like, I went to Iowa State University. Tuition's like, it was like $4,000 a semester. You know, it's not crazy. And the quality of the education was quite high, especially compared to some online courses I've seen where it's like, okay, you really put in the bare minimum effort.
I think a lot of it depends on degree, at least in my opinion.
I want to ask you, because I'm curious how you feel about this. So you had a very low in-state tuition, which was $4,000 a year.
Yes.
Do you think if you spent $16,000 and 4 years that you on a variety of online courses that you couldn't provide a close to or similar experience?
I think I could have gotten the same education personally for free. But it's like about the type of person, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like we could probably create a two-axis graph here on the value of college. It's like, okay, how much are you the autodidactic person who's going to go out and cobble the information together and build freaking spreadsheets and like and figure out how to sequence practice and all that kind of stuff? That's one direction. Mm-hmm. And then what is the economic value and likelihood of getting a high-paying job for the degree you've picked? Mm-hmm. So if you want to be a doctor or a lawyer, you kind of need to go to school.
Sure.
If you want to be an author or you want to be a YouTuber, do you need to go to school? They'll certainly offer you a program, but I think the availability of resources and the barrier to entry is so much lower that it's harder to make a case there.
What do you think? I'll just say what I thought. I took business, and I think that with the exception of like Ben went to Wharton, which is the number one, I think, undergraduate business school in the country, which operates as the outsourced HR for Blackstone and all these other private equity firms. And it's literally just like, you need to go through this process for us to even look at you.
I still think the education at Wharton is mediocre. I think for 4 years and $160,000, guaranteed you can beat it.
Yes.
The benefit is you just get the good job afterwards.
So this is where I feel broadly more comfortable.
It's not for the education. It's literally just because then Goldman Sachs takes you into their loving, abusive arms and pays you several hundred grand.
Well, so I did the 1 year business degree and I was expecting to learn all of these things. And I went in thinking there was a lot to learn about business. I left the program thinking business was dumb and there was nothing to learn. And then I started our business and I realized there was so much to learn.
And that you knew nothing.
And I knew nothing. And so I do think that if you're out there and you're considering a business degree, consider it very, very, considerately.
We did a lot of
as good as Wharton is at placing people, because it is a phenomenal place for placing people. We had a guy who went to the University of Wisconsin and was just sitting right next to me at Blackstone.
How did he do that?
I got to ask him.
Dude, that's what we need to add.
He was the first person ever from that school to get hired by Blackstone, and he sat next to all the Ivy League kids and earned just as much and then went on to the best hedge fund and like is crushing it.
Yeah.
And he networked there. I don't know exactly how. I'll have to actually.
That would be
get him on the podcast.
A good charisma on command thing for our audience.
Yeah, my impression is he basically networked his way into getting an interview.
I think it's absolutely possible. Sorry, no nepotism, you don't think?
No. I asked him, and I only got the high-level part, because at the time I didn't own Charisma on Command. So I was like, how'd you do this? He's like, I just, networking, and I talked to the right people, and I went, well, I don't care. let's go eat lunch. You know what I mean? He's just a friend of mine. I wasn't trying to.
So gotta call him up. Interview him on this podcast, maybe.
What were we saying, though?
Yesterday, Henry was asking me for book recommendations, and I mentioned, Ghosts in the Wires is one of my favorite books.
What is that?
It's written by Kevin Mitnick. He's like in the 80s and 90s, they called him like the world's most dangerous hacker. He's basically a guy who knows a little bit about hacking and from a technical perspective and the phone system, knows a lot about social engineering. He's the guy who can call someone up and just super convincingly lie and say, hey, I'm one of your coworkers. I forgot my password. Can you give me a password?
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing, right? But so I listen to that book every night going to sleep just because I find it fascinating. And I have zero interest in doing any kind of like social engineering, but what it teaches me is, okay, if you can call somebody and get them to do something that they are really not supposed to do because of job security or corporate policy or whatever, like that's the highest degree of social engineering. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely possible that you could network your way into a high paying job that would normally only want an Ivy League degree.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Oh, totally possible. Totally. I'm not saying it must be nepotism. I think that's a common... I feel like this has almost happened to me recently. So I think it happens most in situations where you don't want to either appear dumb or like an outsider. And I feel that right now because I've just earned enough money to start investing. And so we got an email, like I did my first private investment with this psychedelic company. And I just wired them money with no idea where it was going, really. And because I like didn't want to ask dumb questions. And upon realization, I was like, well, that was foolish. And then they hit us up again. And I was like, I think this is crazy, asking for a copy of my passport, like a photo of my passport. Dude, my most recent utility bill. Just like, hey, can I steal your information?
Somebody's trying to become you.
And so I officially am just writing that money off in my head as the cost of learning investment. But I realize the thing that would have made me comply with that request is like not having Ben and not trying to look stupid in front of these people. Mm-hmm. And so instead I asked Ben, I was like, hey, is this normal? But were I trying to like, if they were on the phone and I didn't want to accuse them of being manipulators, I could see myself starting to acquiesce in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
And luckily Ben was like, no, this is crazy. This isn't normal. I was like, good. That was my gut instinct. Why do you need my passport?
Yeah. No one's, I've done private investments. No one's ever asked me for that stuff. So
yeah, that's ridiculous.
I'm going to just not.
Give them,
I'm just going to say, hey, so, I mean, you guys want to just send the money back or are you cool without the passport photo? Cause I'm good either way.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like a powerful tactic, you know, not wanting to look stupid or not wanting to shake up things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So like, in the book, he'll talk about how my favorite example is he wanted to prank his friend. So he called and said, hey, I'm from the IRS. We have a garnishment order for this guy. We need to garnish his wages. And they're like, well, we need proof. And he's like, we'll get you proof on Monday, but don't give him his pay till then. Otherwise, there's going to be problems.
Oh.
And so they halted his pay. No proof.
Yeah.
Wow. They don't want to shake up the system.
Interesting.
And so like not wanting to feel stupid, not wanting to ask dumb questions or insult somebody.
Henry, could you grab that? Sorry. We've got a... This is how people enter our home. Those were horrible. Sorry for the interruption, everybody, but we had a package delivery, which makes the dogs go insane. Also, my dog got sprayed by a skunk 2 days ago. That was horrible. Skunk smell, which you guys haven't realized, is not the worst smell, but is the like strongest, most pervasive smell, I think, on the face of the planet. It is in every nook and cranny of my house, despite the fact that the dog didn't come inside, and it just happened outside of the home. So avoid good, skunks.
Good self-defense mechanism.
Yeah, man. It's messed him up so good. Just destroyed him. He doesn't care though. He's happy.
Well, this is a question I have. I don't know if we can keep this in or cut it, but you mentioned that I like to build things and start things, not maintain things. You also said you started your business 11 years ago. So those seem at odds to me. Like you're still doing productivity and college related stuff to a large degree. There hasn't been a major pivot in 11 years is a really long time for our business. So how do you, I guess, explain that?
There have been minor pivots. So I definitely struggle with burnout and getting bored with doing the same thing.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do.
And I'm always looking for, like, what's the new thing that keeps me interested in it? So I know other YouTubers who are absolute machines, and they can just lock in on a format that works well and do it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, cool, all right, find the next interesting topic, but then keep the format. Mm-hmm. I find that very difficult to do. In fact, I can't really even edit my own videos anymore because for me, for it to be interesting, it's either going to be like a month-long crazy edit where I'm learning something new, or I'm just like, I've done this 1,000 times. I don't want to click this box again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So for me, like I'm building the second channel right now, teaching the basics of Notion. And it's just totally different content. And it's also a totally new channel. So it's fun watching.
If he bothers you, you can send him over here.
It's fun. Are you trying to get over?
Come on, bud.
Come on. It's fun just watching that new channel be built. Even though the scale is, you know, so much less than the main channel.
Well, also that reminds me of something. You're so unmotivated by the pursuit of financial gains, which is interesting because you said the reason you got into this is you saw your dad get laid off and initially you were trying to get money to pay off your student loans, but you regularly will talk about business and you'll be like, oh yeah, this and that. And I'll give you some advice. You're like, I'm so certain that would make me a lot of money, but I'm not going to do it. I'm just like, okay, yeah, that's fair enough. So is that a learned thing? Did you just have that in you? And once you got your student loans paid off, you stopped caring about money. Like, how did you get there? Cause you're actually very good, I think, at not chasing that shiny money object.
Yeah. I'm not sure. All I know is I don't care about having a lot of money. I just care about what money can do for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what I want. I want to live a life where I can constantly learn and try new things. I have learned in the last year that I do not want to live way out in the suburbs. So that requires a bit more money.
Yeah.
Moving to a new house right now. But like, yeah, I'm not like, oh, I need $5 million because I need $5 million or whatever.
And you just never have.
No, I don't really think so. Like I want to make money. I'm not one of those people who's just like, I have zero ambition to make money. Like I do want to make money. And I think about it more in terms of what is it enable me to do, and also does it make me feel more secure, I guess. So
do you feel insecure about money?
Yeah, I was gonna ask.
Not really. No. But like if my bank account was down to like $5,000, I'd be like,
I noticed that as I've said this several times, as I've earned more, I've felt more insecure because I had whatever my own potential makeup is, and it's not horrible, but when I had nothing to lose, it was just like I knew that I was lucky enough to have my rock bottom, which is really, really fortunate, be like move in with mom and dad, live there, don't starve to death, eat the food that they cook at night, and just be socially not real connected or happy.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But
you weren't going to starve to death.
Yes. And I was close to that. I was like hundreds of dollars away from that at various points in time. And I was just like,
if the IRS had hit you up and said, hey, you're $1,000 low on your tax income, you'd have to move on.
Call to mom and dad, be like, let's coordinate.
Yeah.
And now that I'm farther from that, I noticed that I think about money more, which I guess you don't.
So one thing I did notice is as I started to make more money, there was like this ratcheting level of, okay, if my balance goes beneath this, now I'm going to be worried. So I remember being in my apartment with my roommates, like early days of the blog, and I had $5,000. I'm like, okay, if it goes beneath $5,000, now I'm going to be worried. And then it was 10K and it was 20K. And now I'm like, all right, if our bank account balance goes beneath 50, like we're in trouble. But I also at the same time, like I've added a team to my life and I'm more secure with myself than I am about the well-being of my team. So like if it was just me and everything went to hell tomorrow, fine, I'll make it work. I'll sell my house, I'll sell my stuff, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I know I have skills that people are demanding. I could go probably sell a consulting session to a company and make the money I need tomorrow. But now that I have a team, it's like they and their family, like they need to keep their bills paid. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, we socked away 6 months of everyone's pay. Mm-hmm. That's when COVID hit. Because we saw a guy, I won't say who, we saw a guy who claims he's $100 millionaire or something. And his company had like two bad months and he laid off a massive amount of employees.
Oh my gosh.
And that just seemed so shitty because he didn't think to just return any of the alleged $100 million he's got sitting in the bank. He took it out of the business and he's like, this is all mine.
Yeah.
And now the business can't pay the employees. That's the employee's problem. That's the business's problem. It's not my problem. So we were like, all right, we're not doing that. So we just didn't take pay until we had 6 months worth of pay for all our employees. And so now it's like, nothing's going to happen. That's bad, I don't think. So I don't stress about the employees because
6 month runway.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long, if we don't make a single dollar for 6 months, we probably should evaluate with the team. Be like, yes. Hey, how come no one's making any money? What are you guys up to?
Yeah, I don't know how you guys think about this, but one thing that I'm always thinking about is how many income streams do we have?
Really?
So not necessarily the dollar amount in total.
I want to talk about this because we have such different philosophies on business and money. So you think of multiple income streams is important to you.
Yes.
So my thing, this is me 80-20, is like find one horse and ride it until it collapses and dies. And which is, it's just an interesting approach. So why do you think of that? Because that gives you more cushion, that gives you more...
I just think about like, what are the dependencies of each income stream? And at a certain point, you kind of come to realize, oh, well, there's one huge giant dependency for all of them. And it's this company called Google.
Yeah.
Like kind of everything is the lifeblood. Like traffic is the lifeblood of every income source. And Google is the bringer of the traffic one way or the other.
Once you become Trump and Parler and Amazon literally won't give you the server space to host your website, it's all over for us.
Yeah.
So, like everyone's like, oh, don't trust YouTube because then you don't own your list. You should capture emails so you own your list. Like, I guess that works till ActiveCampaign decides I don't own a list.
Well, I mean, I guess we haven't done this in a while. We used to legit export our list as a CSV and save it
every
3 months. And I haven't done it in a while. Actually, I don't think I've done it since I moved to ConvertKit, so I should probably do that. But we have an email list. So I guess even if Google traffic dried up overnight, YouTube traffic dried up overnight, we would have like the people on the email list. We could build something.
Until ConvertKit says that they don't like your political affiliation.
Until ConvertKit, yeah. So I don't know if they're going to do that. I'm pretty milquetoast
online. Yeah. You'll be all right.
What is your...
Talking about productivity.
So your goal when you started the channel was, you know, pay off student loans, all that kind of stuff. Is your goal now just do things that I like and document, learn about stuff? What keeps you going on the channel?
Yeah. It's a lot of that for my personal edification, I suppose. On my main channel, what I want to do is kind of what... I don't remember if I mentioned this earlier. Oh, yeah. You talked about imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. I think about like, all right, where was I 3 years ago, 5 years ago, like out of college, trying to figure things out. Can I make that easier for people? Can I give them resources? Mm-hmm. And I've never been the kind of person who's like, I want to like actually take somebody under my wing and teach them directly. I like to put out resources that sort of let people independently set their own path, but make it easier.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm trying to go with my main channel is like, all right, I'm trying to buy a house right now. I didn't know how to do that. Mm-hmm. There was a bunch of mistakes I could have made. Let me make a video on that. Let me make a video on how do you start investing without screwing up or accidentally wiring your passport to some dude.
Should you wire your passport? That's the next video.
Well, Thomas,
I found it.
Is it safe to assume that the way you invest is ETFs, S&P 500, set it and forget it type investing? Because that seems like your style. Or are you,
so
are you deep into NFTs and cryptos?
Super not in NFTs. If I said anything positive about NFTs, my fiance would hate me so much. She's an artist, so she's just like, NFT people are going to steal my art. And there was like some dude in her DMs like, hey, I'm doing an NFT project. And like I guess he showed her a picture of her art in his Photoshop and she got really pissed.
So what is her concern? Her concern is that because she is not doing her own NFTs, that people will take her artwork, throw it into NFT format.
I'm afraid people are going to steal my art. And then I think it is I don't think she understands the technical details of it, but there's the talking point that NFTs are super bad for the environment, which if you dig into the details of it, like it is sort of true. The Ethereum gas they take up is like way more than any standard ETH transaction. So there is an issue there, but like for me, that seems like a solvable thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you could get on a blockchain that isn't proof of work based. Does that make NFTs worth anything? That's another question for another day. But for investing, my thought is swing for the fences on stuff I have control over and then be pretty safe on the other stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm absolutely like Vanguard ETFs all day long.
John Bogle.
Max out my IRA. Do like all the tricks to make my IRA even more max outable. And then like, you know, building my own businesses or I invested in Standard, my agency. So I partly own that now. Like that's a big swing for this ventures bet.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
But I have control over that. Like I can put my own sweat and tears and ideas into it and make it better.
Yeah, I feel that, with the exception of the shit coins that I bought during the craze.
I have a little bit of Bitcoin.
I do like to try to, the more if I can find a person.
By the way, I put like $500 into that. It was like,
you were like, thousand.
Oh. No, it was not a serious, it was a.
How do you think we got this house?
No, it was like a, going to Las Vegas and you walk past the roulette table and everybody's screaming and having fun. You're like, all right, fine. I'm going to.
Oh, did you?
It's like huge FOMO, right?
Not even FOMO, just like, just want to pretend that I'm intelligent when this goes up 10,000%, or if it goes to zero, it's
like, do you feel this? If I invest in a single stock that is super hyped and going up, I can't stop thinking about it.
Really?
And I'll just check it. Like, yeah, I buy one individual stock, Nintendo, because I like the stock.
Oh, I'm really good at forgetting it.
And I'll forget about that one. Like, I think I am vaguely aware that they're down right now, but I don't care. I don't know what my cost basis was. You know, I remember when the Bitcoin craze came out, I was like, ooh, what companies are getting into blockchain? Overstock.com is, let me just put some money in there. And I'm on my phone every day. Like it went up a dime or went down 5 cents. I should sell now.
What I'm learning from this conversation is everybody just has these weird emotional triggers when it comes to, I'm sure, everything, but money in particular. And like one of mine is not like, once it's out of my bank account and into the hands of these people, if they literally stole that money from me that I sent them, I wouldn't lose a wink. I would barely bring it up in conversation.
Yeah.
Because like, it's
I'm just
praying gone.
That money that allegedly got invested in SpaceX actually got invested in SpaceX.
See, that's the only one. Even that I'm going, probably not.
And I'm just hoping.
Yeah.
I think I would feel the same if I was in your situation. Because like you buy a stock on Robinhood, you are innately aware that at any moment you could sell it or you could buy more. Like there's always another like option there.
I like private investments like that. I gave my private equity for money. However many years ago that was, 9 years ago, and I couldn't get it back even if I wanted to, even if I was defaulting on a mortgage. I can't. It's just gone until I get it back.
It's out of my hands.
It's the best thing ever.
Yep, that's the thing. Like I honestly feel that is better for my mental health.
Yeah, Hellman and Friedman. If anyone's watching, please take more of my money. Every time I try to invest with them, they're just like, "Nah, we're good."
Mm-hmm.
But
this is kind of a hard segue, but it is reminiscent. I wanted to talk about it on the podcast because we discussed it last night. Things you control, that's my segue, being the business, and we had a little...
Oh, I had this on my list of things to talk about.
Do you want to... We had a little kerfluffle yesterday. Long story short, and this is not... I've mentioned that we worked with somebody who's like a podcast viewer, not him. we worked with somebody to do some copywriting. And the offer was, I'll write this copy for your sales page. And copy, for those of you who don't know, is words on a sales page. For free, and in exchange, you'll run a split test. If it wins, we'll share in the upside that that has generated for you.
Sounds great in theory.
Sounds great in theory, and it's proven to not be for a number of reasons, which I will briefly describe. We got the first version of this back after this person had put time, obviously, into making it and setting it up. And I read it. In my opinion, it was, I mean, you said the word incel bait, and it was adjacent to that. It was like, don't stand by while lesser people get the things that you deserve. And like, you know, don't let that happen while you're in the corner resentful. And I was just like, I hate this. I don't like the way this is written.
It's not who we think Charisma on Command viewers are, and it's not who we made the course for.
Right. Yes. And in addition to that, there was, I think, you know, guesses as to like piecing together elements of the story that I had talked about, like how I did my thing, but trying to write it in a way that was engaging. So taking guesses as to what exactly in that particular moment motivated me and like messing the timeline up. So some of it in a way that is understandable, but also like check with me, was not factually true. And so I'm going through the page and we left a bunch of things on it, said, hey, change this, change this, change this at a high level. We moved. There was some miscommunication in the shuffle. And now this individual is upset with you because you haven't run the test fast enough because you were leading this.
Yep.
And we were kind of like frustrated with the quality of this page. So it's like it's value lost in this interaction.
Everybody has had the pleasure of feeling negative emotions in this process.
And what Ben and I were doing, which you sort of checked us on, which was we felt that like our primary obligation was to the word that we gave to this person, which is we said, hey, if you write this page, we will then split test it.
And then the guy sent us the page that he did put effort into, and his team put effort into it, and we didn't like it. And if I had just paid him 10 grand to write that, I would have gone, okay, cool, I'm going to kill this. I would have said, my deal was I gave you 10 grand, here's the 10 grand, you gave me a page, I don't like it, so I kill it. But instead it was, you'll do this for free and we'll run it. So I felt obligated to instead try to make the page something that we could run. Because I thought that it would be breaking my word to not run this page, even though I don't like it. And then last night you had a really interesting point, which was that there's another moral obligation as well, which is to not give that frame to people who like
I'll
you.
I'll let you say it. You have your own take on it.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can get into a few things here, but I've been in the personal life advice space for a very long time. You guys are in it, whether you want to brand your way that yourselves that way or not. I feel that there is a responsibility people like us have to ensure there's a moral backing to what we say. Because I've seen a ton of people, I've had conversations with people I won't name, who are just like, if they fall victim to this, it's their fault, you know? Or like, yeah, I know it's a scam, but it, you know, if they fall victim, whatever. Like, they were stupid. That's on them. I don't think so. And I think this makes me a little bit of like an anti-libertarian, because I feel like it's erring towards, we need to set policy that helps people, you know, avoid the worst of themselves.
Yeah.
But I realize there's a kid out there who's 17 years old, because I was a 17-year-old impressionable kid one time. And I feel lucky that the people who I took advice from and looked up to had my best interest in mind, or, you know, weren't willing to say shitty things. So I'm not going to do that. And I'm going to think about that. It's why I don't talk about like nootropic drugs on my channel, because you, like, if I say anything other than this stuff is not researched, don't do it, there's going to be somebody who's like, oh, Tom is sort of interested in them. That means they're all good. I'm going to just go take them all, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why I don't talk about stuff like that on the channel. And I guess that permeates every decision I make. Is this good for the audience? So when you guys told me about this, I'm like, I do think it was probably a mistake to make these promises up front, like especially the there's no caveat on I'll run this only if it's good or only if we stand behind it.
Yeah.
But ultimately at the end of the day, like you're between a rock and a hard place, but the worst thing to do is to put something you don't believe in, you don't stand behind in front of your audience and allow that to maybe influence them.
Yeah, no, no. And what we ended up doing is putting a lot of work into editing it. And what you were saying is you would have just killed it, which I think is a reasonable alternative.
I think so.
Well, what you're saying is that implicit, so this is the way I was thinking, is like, every contract has covert clauses, right? Like, and I will not, I don't know, use this information with your address to break in your house and hold you ransom. You know what I mean? Like it's not stated in most contracts, but it's implied. And so what you were saying is like, look, implied in any contract where anyone comes to work for my business is that you will do right by my fans and customers. And that means you will not lie. You will X, Y, you know, and I think also that you'll provide quality. And what we sort of got sucked into is this predictably irrational Dan Ariely free thing where like, oh, someone will do this for free and didn't take into account that that puts us on the hook to fix copy that isn't honest or doesn't match the vibe that we want it to do to, you know, deal with this person, even if we don't feel that they're being, what is the word? Civil when we entered into this contract and you're saying like, no, it's totally reasonable for there to be covert clauses in there, which are the ones that I sort of just said, they can't lie and these sorts of things. But in any event, what we're going to do is we've now spent between Ben and I don't know, at least 5 hours going through this page, rewriting it in a way that I was like, I can stand behind this now. And we will do the split test because we said we would, but it was a just really good lesson. So if you're out there, things that we've learned. Free has a cost. I know this. I've learned this before. Why does it take me so long?
Well, this came through a friend was I think the reason. Because we get hit up all the time for free. Hey, can I write you for free? Can I for free? And we always
it's
say
always
no.
Though. Yeah, but this came through a friend.
And so that just went through my defenses. I guess I didn't have that same skepticism.
I'll tell you, if you're in a business, another one, if a copywriter doesn't, especially if it's like a thing like doesn't talk to customers or I think it would be important to talk to me. Like, I actually think people misunderstand copywriting. And that's kind of what I came to last night. People think of copywriting as like, my job is to write persuasive words that make people buy a product. And I think if we ever do copywriting or train copywriters, it's like, no, your job is to be a customer success expert. And that's to be involved in the product and figure out what it takes to get this from an 8.7 star rating to a 9.5 star rating. Yep. And then to mention that those things now exist in the product on the sales page. Yeah. It's to like redesign the product, add the pieces that are necessary, find out what's missing so that it's so awesome that all that you have to do is talk about it. You know, and of course, yes, you can tell stories and there's, you know, ways of framing things that are more powerful while still being honest than other ways of framing things. So there are some copywriting tools that I'm not throwing out, but having done this many times, I realized that like, that's how you have a winning sales page is you add to the product such that it works and sells more. So anything else that you learned?
Well, I mean, this is separate from the business thing, but something I took away from this was the message this person wrote me was quite entitled, I thought. And it completely triggered me to the point where I have gone from neutral / positive to like very negative on this person. If anyone asked me if they should work with them, I would strongly suggest not to. And they actually could have accomplished the same thing if they just come in more humble or like more requesting instead of demanding. And so it was just a good, I mean, lesson for me if I'm ever on the other end of trying to get someone to do something or do something faster is coming in like they owe you and being entitled about what they have to do is so much less persuasive than coming in and explaining why you want them to.
Let's make this concrete.
Is
there nuance here? Okay, so what you're saying is like, hey, I'll just give you a general thing, not this particular one. We, you know, have worked hard on this. Could you please try and get it up? It would mean a lot to me as like for X, Y, and Z reasons. Like I understand that there's probably stuff going on, but if you could,
I did this for free and money's tight. And I know it's not your top priority by any means, but if it's possible to get it up by the end of the week, that would be amazing. And
so charisma question, is there nuance here? Cause that position is coming in from a position of non-dominance. You're using a lot of, you know, if you could just using some minimizing hypothetical requesting language. I've talked in the past and I just want to see if I can make a principle here. That's not always appropriate. There's people that overdo the, if you could please just. So I'm curious if there's like a framework that one can use to know whether or not they should go in.
What would be an example where you're better off coming in trying to be dominant?
I think that there are people who habitually, I can do this from time to time, minimize their needs and requests. Could you just, you know, and for that reason, get walked over because there's not an assertive line of like, can you stop that? And I guess there's still a question there, which is, you know, hey, when you do this, it's upsetting. Can you stop that? As opposed to, there, I don't know exactly, but I have seen and can imagine times where it's a bit frustrating. Could you just, you know, where you make it so tiny small that it just gets mm-hmm. ignored. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if there's a framework for one to decide, but I don't think it's always being a supplicative.
No. Well, yeah. I mean, so I'll just say, for instance, in this example, we can try to work through it together. This person has like no leverage. They're mm-hmm. not my boss. There is no mechanism with which they, if they were saying, if you don't get this up, I'm going to terminate the contract and you're not allowed to use it at all. Mm-hmm. That could be a stronger position. And you could still come in humbly like that. You say, hey, totally get if this isn't a priority for you. If it's not up by the end of the week, let's just kill it. Like, I'll own the IP. You do this. You know what I mean? Some mm-hmm. form of adding real scarcity, mm-hmm. which isn't a demand and it's not entitled. It's just a, here's how things are going to be, mm-hmm. which I think is different than coming in and just trying to say, hey, you, it felt a little bit like someone coming into a restaurant demanding that the menu be changed. And then when the chef says no, they're like, I'm the customer. You have to. It's like
you're kind of saying don't overstate your position.
I don't have to. I'm the chef. You can just leave. And yeah, so exactly. if someone's saying, "Hey, I'm allergic to cheese, and everything on your menu has cheese. Yeah, yeah. Could you please change it? Otherwise, I'm going to leave." And then mm-hmm. if the chef's like, "No," it's like, "Okay, I'm really going to take my money elsewhere."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think, but either way, you don't have to be necessarily gruff about it.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, it's about stating your position and being willing to take action, being willing to leave, saying, hey, I don't actually need, if you want to be a strong position, like you say you don't need the upside from this project a waste of your time. Yeah, and
I've got it.
You're going to leave and just take the sales page away. Or if we can get it up sooner, that would be my first choice if that's possible. I don't want to be on the hook anymore.
What you're correctly identifying is, I think, and I don't know, that in this particular case and many others, that strong, hey, you have to, is to mask an inner feeling of vulnerability. Mm. And that does not come across well, because in this position, as you correctly identified, there is a vulnerability to their position, which is, I've already done this work and you don't necessarily have to. And I actually don't have any levers. And even morally, there's not a lot of reasons that I can compel you to follow through if I did bad work here.
Right.
So what you're saying is, represent your position as it actually is, and it will go.
Yeah. And maybe you vary it based on the person to person, but for me, at least, it's just going to be way more effective to come in and say, hey, I'm stressed. I was expecting money to be coming in from this project already, and it's not, and I need the money. So could you get it up? I'm like, oh, yeah, shit. Sorry, I didn't realize that things were tight. I'll get this up ASAP. Like, that's going to be way more effective than...
Possibly. I mean, I guess, like, that's appealing to your sense of goodness and decency.
Yeah, yeah.
But it isn't really providing any sort of business value to you for me to say, hey, I'm...
It's also not, it doesn't provide any business value to just say, hey, I got you this 2 weeks ago. You have to put it up by end of day. It's like, this is also not valued me.
No, that's
just,
pisses
me off.
Not really a good way for him to provide value at this point. So.
No, but I think what you can do is try to get a read on the person's ethics, or let's say their motivators, mm-hmm. you know, and try to hone in on what will be persuasive to them.
So you're saying he got a bad read on you.
I don't know who that works for, but yeah, you got a bad read on me by thinking that acting like I'm your employee is the way to get me to do something. Yeah.
So I have three business lessons that I pulled from this.
Okay.
But one of them was the way you reacted to how he said that, his tone. It's like his copy was full of this stuff. Like, get what people who are
deserve.
Lesser than you.
Oh, Thomas, you think you just
get what I deserve. No. Look at how you reacted when he acted that way. I deserve this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Dude, Thomas, you nailed it. You just said it. He wrote copy, and this is what always happens with copywriters. We had some guy, and again, not a bad dude, we had a dating thing, and he wrote it to himself.
Yeah, this was great. I actually really liked this guy as a person, mm-hmm. but he clearly had a lot of struggles with women, and the copy he wrote was very
emblematic of that. And so you nailed it. They write deserving copy, which is, I hate the word deserve. I think I took it out almost throughout the entire page, but the concept of deserving something to me is so tenuous at best, mm-hmm. but it was rife throughout this page. And there was a lot of, it's not your fault, which is classic copywriter, and a lot of unjust worlds. And you're like, oh my God, what do you know? That came through strongly in those words.
Actually, that's a great
lesson. Brilliant takeaway, man.
What people, what they write Yeah, that represents what's going on in their head.
Yeah, that's sharp. Mm-hmm. Sorry for shouting over you, but you just freaked me out. Go ahead.
By the way, that shouldn't be the case. A good copywriter, like our sales page, to the extent that it's done well, is because it doesn't represent Ben Altman at the time. I interviewed 30 people and then tried to represent them on the page. So a good writer shouldn't do that. But I do think, it's funny enough. It seems like this person's.
I mean, that's like the natural shortcut. If you don't go out and get what your customer wants, then you're going to naturally lean on what you think you would want if you were in a situation.
Yeah, you just try to pretend you're that person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what else you got?
I mean, the fact that you guys took the recommendation from your friend and then agreed to this deal without really any objection, that's just the power of testimonial right there.
Yes. So. Yes. Testimonials are the most powerful thing ever.
We've seen this, and I'll say, you guys have seen the end of our Charisma University sales, and they've evolved over the years. A little podcast insider tip. When we added testimonials, we 4x conversions, which is sales. So the same thing. Hey, this is what's in the program. Here's what it does. Also, I think it's good. When we added the quotes of people who have emailed me, 4x as many sales.
Yeah, we also hired a business coach solely because Tony Robbins said he was good.
Yeah. Dude, testimonials, I think, are, and this is it, word of mouth from people you know is the most powerful sales force.
Yes.
And so build a business that creates that. But
Go read you guys have read Influence, I'm guessing.
Yeah, of course.
Like the whole chapter on liking, like people want to listen to those who they feel are like them, which, you know, your friends are like you.
Yeah.
So you listen to them. And then the last thing was...
Sometimes it is useful, though. Like, so for instance, we could probably delineate why. You have great audio and great video quality in your videos.
Bought $5,000 camera last night because you said, hey, should
hang on. It's two cameras for $5,000.
We didn't do any research. We didn't
literally not a link.
We didn't Google and say, as we said, oh, Thomas says these are the best cameras. And we bought them. And I actually don't think that's a bad tool there.
Yeah, like, so what do they call that? Like the expert... fallacy or the expert bias, right? That's a useful heuristic. You know, if I go into my doctor and I'm like, are you sure that I should be taking ibuprofen here? Because I see these chemistry diagrams in here, and then there's this like number needed to treat statistic that I got from, like, no. At a certain point, I need to trust my doctor for certain things because I don't have, you know, so there's like always this dance between like being skeptical.
Don't trust surgeons though.
But not surgeons.
Seriously, I do feel that way.
You think so?
Yeah, I've had multiple surgeons tell me I needed a surgery that when I got second and third opinions, there was conflict.
I guess that's the real hack is get the second and third opinion.
And you're combining two things. The two things that you're combining in this case are that surgeon, independent of the financial incentive, probably would have given you the right decision. But when you financially incentivize him to make a boatload of money by cutting you open.
Correct. Thomas makes no money, unless he secretly works for Sony, from recommending those cameras.
I'm a secret Sony shill.
But surgeons, from my experience, when they're the ones getting paid, surgery seems like a pretty good option.
I mean, there's that old saying, right? You know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yep.
So it's tough to actually work past that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I have that problem. People are like, should I use Notion for this? And I'm like,
always.
I really want to say yes, but what you described, I don't know. Or people will be like, should I invest the same platform you invested in? I want to do absolutely no thinking. I'm like, okay, well then no.
Yeah.
Because like that, and that's something like I have certain influencer friends who are like, if I don't use it personally, I won't recommend it. And I think that's stupid. Because there are products out there that are tailored for people who are not like me.
Oh, yeah. So for example, try to follow that rule.
I don't put my money into Wealthfront because I am not willing to give the 0.25% management fee to them because I know I can go build my own portfolio.
Yep.
I do it on M1. I have a specific portfolio that I've constructed that I think is a little bit more aggressive than just throwing it all into SPY. And I like it. But I also know what a management fee is. Yeah. And I also like to read investing books. And I when I hear friends say, I do not want to think about it, I understand the fact that if I say, okay, here's what a 3-fund portfolio is, international diversification, a bond fund, and a, you know, putting most of your money in the stocks, that's like TV stack to them.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And when you give people too much detail or too many choices, they will fail to make a decision sometimes. So if I hear, I want you to give me one word, just tell me where to go.
Yeah.
It's Wealthfront. Happily, you will give up the 0.25% other than because the alternative is not investing at all.
We're not sponsored by Wealthfront, though. So, Justin, you just bleep every time that he says Wealthfront.
Got
out
it.
Of here.
And then all we'll
right?
contact
no free,
them.
No free lunch. All right. It's like when Kawhi Leonard threw the Gatorade away.
I agree with you very much in that in order to recommend something, we have several things, but one of them is, do I use it or would I recommend this to someone in a in a particular position?
Do you believe in it?
Yeah, yeah.
I believe in it, but I don't use it because I have a different set of needs.
Well, I would do it. So we have some questions for our sponsors, and one of them is, do I or someone I know have a strong? Mm-hmm. So for instance, I make the Charisma on Command videos now, but if we had a sponsor who I'd never used, but if Charlie had used Hims and thought it was incredible, I would feel comfortable going up there and saying, you know, from what I've heard, Hims is great if you have hair loss problems. Yeah. I wouldn't say I take it because I don't, but that would be good enough for me.
Yeah.
Like, so it's not that I personally have to, but I do want to know individuals.
Yeah, you want to get somebody you trust
used it. I wouldn't just trust their website saying that they're good, being like, oh, that's good enough for me.
Like, I'm looking at a motorcycle right here. You guys can't see it, but so I ride a Triumph. There is, and like, it was my beginner bike, but I'm 6'2". I've mountain biked my whole life. Like, it's, I am not the average 17-year-old kid who needs a small beginner bike. Like, a 900cc Triumph was fine for me. That being said, Triumph does not make a bike that I would consider to be a beginner-friendly bicycle or motorcycle. Mm. So if someone's like, what should I buy if I want to get into motorcycling? I'm never going to recommend the bike that I bought.
Yeah.
Because I know that I'm the edge case. Mm-hmm. And if it's like someone who's never ridden before, they don't do downhill mountain biking, I'm like, you're going to go buy like a Ninja 350 or something really simple, or Honda Rebel. I've never owned either of those bikes, but I know people, like 5'2" girls who ride those. I know them well enough to know that's the thing to recommend.
You recommended me a Sony that you don't have. I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, because I shoot Canon. And the thing is, like, if you want to do a long podcast like this or a long whatever you're doing over there.
On a tighter budget.
I don't know if it's like a secret project, but.
It's D&D.
No. Okay. We talk about it all the time.
Okay, if you want to do a long D&D thing, Canon does not make a camera that doesn't have that stupid 29-minute recording limit until you get to the $6,000 C70. They just don't. So if you don't want to pay $6,000, and I'll happily recommend you $6,000 cameras. Yeah, if you don't want to pay
$6,000,
you got to go Sony, you know?
So let's do the third. What was the third business thing?
The third one is when you took the deal of I'll do this for free, but I get the upside for 4 months. You are giving him the incentive and basically carte blanche to abuse your audience, because all he cares about, or at least you should assume all he cares about, is getting the sale. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how he does it. It doesn't matter if he damages your reputation doing it. It doesn't matter if he turns away a bunch. Like, if he could bring a ton of people in, but most of them hate it, they're going to come away hating you guys.
Yeah.
If I'm like, hey guys, give me $500 and I'll turn it into $1,000 and I get to keep $100. Like, I don't know. I could go to the mob and like get you guys debt or something. I don't know. So like, if I'm going to bring somebody in and they get upside in terms of sales percentage, I want them to be part of the team and I want them to be part of the mission.
I am increasingly moving towards that. So in the past, I wanted the thinnest organization and contractors if we ever needed them.
The pitch was, though, that there would be ongoing, like this was this was project 2 of 8 on a document that he and I went through.
But let me put it this way. We were both fine not interacting very closely with him. And now in the future, it's like I'm more of the mindset like, look, if you're going to come work with us in any sort of meaningful capacity, we got to sit down and talk.
Yeah, I am increasingly finding that and I'm sure it works for some things, but the dream of delegating and outsourcing that I think gets pitched a lot in the startup world, or at least in the 4-hour workweek world, has not played out for us. Like, our editor got so much better when there was a manager working with him.
And when we were, it was a pass down the lane. We were working super closely with Ivan, who was working super closely with Andre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now they're great. Now they don't need us involved at all, but there's training. And I think the same thing, we thought that hiring a writer, you just find a writer. Now I'm of the opinion that anyone who writes for Charisma on Command is going to have been trained for a year plus before they can really do it. I think I had that dream from the 4-hour work week. It's like, oh yeah, you just eliminate, automate, delegate, and stuff. You got to train really if you want good work, is my experience. I'm sure other people
disagree. I have a
question
for our work week. So I was reflecting on this as I read this copy, and it made me think of the 4-hour work week, because the 4-hour work week, one of my favorite books, undersells how difficult it is. It's not actually a 4-hour work week. It takes a lot of time to get there, and he paints this super compelling dream that just made me jump out of my seat and start.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I wouldn't market that way, but I'm glad he did.
Yeah.
But that's not good enough for me to justify doing it.
So this was my question.
We would be more pissed at Tim Ferriss if he was selling some guru course. But he never did.
I guess here's the thing. It was a $9 book.
Yeah.
And so for him to make the dreams, like all the work that came after that sound easy. Oh, here's the difference. There's no sales page for the 4-hour work week. The 4-hour work week is a sales page to work. You know what I mean? It's a sales page like, to pay other people to help you and do other things. It's not like, it's not, he's not selling the 4-hour work week to sell you his how to build a business course.
Yeah, he enriches himself by selling the book, but he doesn't enrich himself by getting you to become an entrepreneur.
Exactly.
He has not gotten.
So I think for that reason, it works and is clean.
Well, I do actually think, while that is true, I do think it is still the case that that book does, I think, undersell how hard it is.
Yeah, by a fat margin.
And so the question is like, when is that acceptable, if ever?
Let's ask a question here. How many people have read that book, got it into their head that it should be easy, and are out there taking shortcuts?
Or it's hard and they quit. I think that's the most likely. Actually, it's shortcuts.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who are out there like, oh, it should be easy, so I'm going to scam people because that's easier.
Sure.
So that
my impression from talking to people in our audience is that the most common thing seems to be like, I started and it was hard.
Yeah.
So I just don't do it anymore.
I've met people who did that, and I've met people who were like, oh, this is supposed to be easy. So they seek out the other people who are saying and reinforcing this should be easy. Mm-hmm. And then they go down these paths where it's like, here's how it's easy. You do these things.
Become a coach that coaches coaches on how to coach coaches.
So I guess like here's, if I think about it this way, I have now done this. Would I write a book saying it's really easy? I don't think so.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. I couldn't write the 4-hour. I'm personally, as Ben Altman, glad that that book was written in that way. Because I don't think I necessarily would have.
If he described what it was going to require, it would have been less exciting.
Yeah. I mean, he still could have gotten me. Hey, listen, you're going to work a lot. You're not going to make a lot of money for the first couple of years, but you will get to live in Brazil on the beach. Like, I still would have signed up for it, I think. But
yeah,
I do think it's just written in the most compelling way possible. It's going to be easy and effortless. And and I'm glad, I appreciate that as Ben Altman, but I don't think that Charisma on Command should adopt that mindset.
To defend him, he doesn't say easy and effortless, I don't think, at any point. What he does is just kind of skip over. Like, he's like, you put up a Google ad and you sell this product.
Yeah.
And like, this product sells and now you're making $10. Like, your first product doesn't work. Ever.
No. Google ads don't work. I don't want to go bad on Tim at all. I think it's great. But no, I'm sure he says, and then you write a sales page that converts.
Yeah.
And then you get sales.
Yes.
It's like, well, that's a 4-month process.
Yeah.
It was like French striped shirts.
French striped shirts are going to be your muse business.
Drop ship them.
Yeah.
And then you do like the, I don't know, 10 minutes of preliminary research about dropshipping. You realize, hey, the margins on this are zero. Yeah.
He does actually say that he's never worked a 4-hour work week. Mm-hmm. You know, he is quick to say, I think that the title's a bit of hyperbole, and he always has worked more than that.
There's a tremendous, I guess what I'm struggling with is personally, and you've raised the question of, am I the outlier? Is the world worse off for having had him talk not as directly to the trials and tribulations that are very, very common in entrepreneurship?
We do talk about the different gurus. I won't go bad on anyone, but there's a lot of people who teach that type of stuff. And when you meet successful entrepreneurs, they never say, oh, well, if not for blank, I would never have been successful. I can think of a couple of people where I've literally heard it once in my life from all the people I've met. Tim Ferriss has actually inspired a solid amount of people I know who are successful. So he does have that anecdotal thing going for him in my mind, which is that when I meet people who are doing well, they're often like, oh yeah, Tim Ferriss inspired me. And they're doing it. Whereas the people who have failed or are scamming people, they tend to point to other gurus.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to Tim's credit, he didn't say the way you get successful is this method I have over here, pay me. He just, you know, he basically laid out like, this is the framework.
Yeah.
But I do think he glossed over just how difficult it is.
Hey, maybe it was easier in 2007 when he wrote it.
Yeah.
You know
maybe,
what?
Maybe dropshipping was actually much easier 14 years ago.
I actually think the Google ad thing worked. I think the Google ad thing used to work.
Yeah. There were things that worked. Like, I remember 2013, if you want to start a podcast, guaranteed you were on iTunes New and Noteworthy for 8 weeks.
Wow.
8 weeks on at least the New and Noteworthy for your subcategory.
Yeah.
Now,
No, I want to give him credit for that too. Nope. Before Amazon FBA and all that stuff, if you were bringing in something from China through dropshipping, it might have been easy and profitable. You know, this is 14 years ago that he wrote it. So maybe things got harder. So
there's always like pockets of opportunity that are open for a while. And then you publicize this kind of stuff and the competition increases and then it closes.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there are other things that exist today, like TikTok and YouTube algorithms didn't really exist back then. Yeah, so
growing on TikTok is ridiculous. Growing on TikTok is, I mean, especially 6 months or a year ago, was so much easier.
Is PTY still going to be open?
No, it closed.
Oh, okay,
closed.
Never mind.
You can mention it.
I was going to say, we were promoting Ali Abdaal's course on how to make a YouTube channel. So if people actually were interested in that, we'll promote it again in 3 months
when
it opens.
Wait list.
I think there's isn't there like a self-paced one you could always get?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I'm not sure. I was looking at the sales page a while ago, studying it. I think that's the best, like, that's the best education you're ever going to get is studying hyper-analyze what people are doing,
yeah,
not what they tell you to do.
That's what we base our business on.
Like, I guess there's two of it, right? Because, like, I can hyper-analyze what an Olympic figure skater does, and there's stuff that they're just doing it too fast. I need to go to a coach and have her tell me, bring your freaking knee in, otherwise you can't spin. Mm-hmm. And, like, I wouldn't be able to see that on TV. But there is a lot of, you need to actually observe what the pros are doing.
People actually do it and slow it for surfing. People just slow it down. People will get Telly Slater popping up, and you'll be like, okay, we're going to watch this at 0.2 speed.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to show you exactly what he does that you don't do. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
it is helpful. I mean, at least in my experience, that's been helpful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's good. With physical things, a lot of times you want a coach looking at what you're doing specifically, because at least in my case, like with figure skating, with singing, there will be things I'm doing I can't even tell that I'm doing them mm-hmm. until a coach is like, singing, here, I took a video.
One, yeah.
You're doing this. Bring the leg in. Or you're really nasally, and you don't sound the same to yourself in your head as you do in real life. So you can't really tell, like, oh, I should be bringing the voice back down into the throat and making it more full, like, until you have somebody tell you.
Do you like the way you sound on camera when you shoot your videos?
The way I sound on camera?
Yeah, because you said your voice sounds different in your head versus...
Oh, I think I sound fine on camera. Yeah, I've never been embarrassed with my voice on camera. I've been embarrassed with my singing voice. 3 years of vocal lessons will help that a lot.
So I did singing lessons for a long time. This man, singing is crazy. I can't think of anything else in the world that a 5-year-old can do much better than most 40-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And did they just come out perfect? Like just brilliant singers. Nor can I think of anything that I've worked as hard at singing and made as little progress. I've had very good coaches, and I know that they're like, wait, shouldn't you be better? They work with famous people and they help them and they do better.
Yeah.
But I've made limited improvements with singing.
My experience with singing, like, I've gotten to the point where I'm okay with my voice, and I do have one song I produced that sounds pretty good. It's almost like there's a threshold. Mm-hmm. Like, say you're starting to lift and you're squatting, and right now you squat 150 pounds. Mm-hmm. 300 pounds is the point at which you will think, I sound okay.
Yeah, it's far away.
So it's years you need to put 150 pounds on your squat just to be like, cool, I sound okay. And I feel like I finally, just in the last maybe 6 months, got to that point. And now I'm to the point where it's like, I have the base and now I can sculpt it to sound just a little bit better in the dimensions that I'm interested in.
Can you summarize or briefly, because what I think the biggest thing that has helped or could help, if I haven't worked as hard at it, is actually ear training. To me, it's the feedback loop not being perfect is, I think, what has gotten in my way the most. So I'll, like, sing a song, and the best people that I've had, hey, they've let me sing and get away with it, but, like, just so you know, like, you're not hitting some of these notes. You're, like, hitting the high note, and you're hitting the one in between, but all these, like, little words in between, you're just kind of fudging on your way to somewhere else.
So you're saying your coach does tell you that or doesn't?
I think, strike a good balance of, like, not being militant about it and letting me sing a little. And also, stop. Yeah, not that.
Yeah.
But pointing out, like, this, you know, this will come, but I thought, I was like, oh, this is the big note that I have to get. And I was like, I'm hitting that. Fine. It's just all the ones in between that seem unimportant.
And you rush to it, and then it all sounds terrible.
Yeah.
I've done a few things that help. So working with my coach, he'll let me sing a whole section, and then we'll critique it. We've done another thing where I asked him, like, hey, can you basically become a reaction YouTuber for me? So I sent him a recording, and I'm like, use Loom to listen to this on your computer and then pause and just tell me what you think at each point.
Yeah.
So he just sends me back, like, a Loom video of him critiquing and reacting to my singing. Cool. That's really nice. And then one thing I do is I have a little VST called Nectar that Isotope makes, and it comes with a pitch corrector. Mm. It's basically just a suite of vocal enhancement tools. So I will sing, and then I'll throw Nectar on, and I'll figure out the key of the song. You can Google it almost every time. And I'll just throw on the correction and be like, how different does it sound?
That's smart. Because what that eliminates mostly is, how am I pitchy?
Yes.
And if you're like, hey, it sounds good when I'm not pitchy, it's like, cool, we know what I have to work on. Or it's like, no, I nailed it, and it still sounds awkward. It's like, no, then it's my tone. Like, something awkward there. That's smart.
I also have a kind of unfair advantage. My fiance has, like, annoyingly good pitch detection.
Yeah.
I don't have it. Like, I can be a little bit off key. And
I hate people that have that.
So I'll be singing in the shower or something, and then she's like, dear, you sound pretty good, but you're a little flat today. And that just tells me, okay, I just need to just reach a little bit.
It's wild that little kids come with that in a way that I couldn't hit if I practiced for 10 years. Mm. Like I said, I can't think of anything else that is so inborn or possibly inborn, but not guaranteed inborn.
I don't think it's as inborn as people think, though. Like, I do think there is a lot of natural talent variation between singing, mm-hmm. Between people for singing, but I also think that there's a lot more you can do with your voice than most people think. Mm. And it's just, it's a super long-term thing. So think about how many years you've spent talking into a microphone trying to sound good just for your videos. Because I did that as well. Like, I started podcasting in 2013. So it's like 2013 to 2017, four straight years of, you know, trying to sound good into a microphone for podcasts and videos. That was actually a foundation that made it easier for me to start singing.
Interesting.
So I don't think of myself as being, you know, a singer for 3-4 years. I think of myself as having been sculpting my voice for 8-10 years.
Well, in that case, I'm even worse than I thought because I spent a lot more time. By the way, we mentioned 4-hour work week, but give a shout out here to Marketing Step by Step. We've worked with them in the past. They're a podcast sponsor, at least in the sense that we have a deal with them where if you purchase their program, which normally costs $1,000, you go through our link. It's ebonpagantraining.com/charisma. It'll be in the description if you're here on YouTube. It costs $97 and half of that goes to Justin. It's awesome. It's the course that gave us the name Charisma on Command. It's the course that identified our customer avatar. And it's one of the things that we were talking about with this whole debacle that happened this week was that the best programs that we've ever gone through all focus on customer first.
Yep.
And like, this was our first exposure to that. And it's really, really good. It's got exercise. And we also modeled the daily breakdown when we did Charisma University. So it's a very good course.
Yeah, I would say Tim Ferriss gave us the dream. Mm-hmm. But Eben and Marketing Step by Step gave us a blueprint to be successful. And mm-hmm. we were so much less successful until we found that course. And that course really, really helped transform our business. So if you're at the point where you know you want to start a business or you have started a business and it's just not working or you don't know how to grow it, Marketing Step by Step can be an incredibly powerful course.
I would say it's a very good beginner to beginner intermediate course, or if you just like miss the marketing, the actual good guts of marketing stuff. It's very, very good. So check it out, evanpagantraining.com/charisma. Thanks for sponsoring.
Well, there's one thing that Thomas and I were talking about off air that we were like, oh, we could talk about it off air or on air. So it's kind of up to you.
Go for it.
But we were just brainstorming titles based on that format that we saw that absolutely crushed for Psych2Go. Mm. So they just had an interesting format.
A little PTYA. I'll just say what we're talking about. So this actually, so Ollie does a great job on, it's his course, PTYA, Part-Time YouTuber Academy. I have for this cohort decided to join with him. And my part is I'm going to be doing a workshop on making videos that go viral, a workshop on monetization, but charisma on camera. And then for the people that joined through our thing, we'll have our own little private shindig, little get together, and we'll talk about specifics of their channels. But my big thing when I talk to YouTubers that I don't hear people talk about is after you found, let's say that you know your niche and you're like, I like this, there's an audience for it, I feel like I can get in. People don't consider format. That's the one thing. Format is like, is this an interview? Is it a talking head? Talking head doesn't do very well. Every format has a multiplier. Talking head has the lowest multiplier. Breakdowns have a much better multiplier. But you actually were saying title mm-hmm. format. Then if you look at titles, there's a structure to what works on YouTube. So one basic format is like how I da 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 in 30 days. Matt DiVella does I did X for 30 days.
Yep.
Like, and where X is something that the audience is curious about.
Cold shower, meditate.
Cold shower, yes.
Stop drinking, intermittent fasting. Just so, things that they're like, oh, I want to do this thing, but I haven't tried it yet. And this guy's going to tell me what's up.
And there are title structures that have multipliers. They're like, we've started using and abusing how to turn X into Y, where X is the thing that you don't want socially, and Y is the thing that you do want socially.
Well, this is that to the next level.
So then, Ben, this is a new format we've not done, which we saw in another channel, and they've been using and abusing.
So there's, you know, how to be more confident.
Yeah.
And then there's how to turn anxiety into confidence, how mm-hmm. to turn a thing you have and you don't like into a thing you want. This one was Psych2Go, 6 signs you're burnt out, not lazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's 6 signs that you think you have this thing, but actually it's this other thing that's not
as bad.
Nearly as bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like, oh, it's 6 signs you're this thing that's not bad, not the thing that's bad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like, you don't want to be lazy. Like, that's not a thing mm-hmm. that you want to identify with, but being burned out because you have been working hard in the past, that's much more desirable of a state. And it's also more temporary. If you're burned out, you can be unburned out. But if you're lazy, you're just damned to be lazy.
It reflects poorly.
And
on
so
you.
My question was like, how do we charisma on command this? I think Thomas's should just do six signs you're burned out, not lazy.
Just the same title.
You're the productivity guy. Yeah. Just take the titles. So many people have taken our titles and we've taken other titles.
And this is what I do, by the way, in terms of titles and that kind of stuff. What I do, if I see a title, I'm like, I want that title. I don't watch the video. I very purposely don't watch the video. I write my script and then I watch the video to make sure that it's not too close.
I actually did, when I did the police interrogation video, I wrote the whole video and then I watched CoffeeZilla's video and it was too similar.
Yeah, it's,
so I had to go back and I was like, I can't publish this because they're both on this same topic, basically, different titles, I think. But so I went and added some points and removed some points to... It's you can only do so much because both are based on the same actual footage, method published in books that cops learn.
Yeah.
But I was like, I got to mix this up. And so I changed some clips. I like had to not copy.
What do we got? So five signs. I like
six signs. You're burnt out, not lazy. So I was like, how do I do this?
Introverted is the first one. Six signs. You're introverted, not shy. Six signs. You're introverted, not a social pariah. Better way of saying
I was thinking like not a loser. Like six signs you're introverted, not a loser.
I think
six
introverted,
signs
not
introverted,
shy, might
not
do well.
Awkward.
Introverted, not awkward. Introverted, not awkward is interesting.
Yeah, because I don't know that people actually shy. I think is something people are more comfortable being. It's just like I'm shy, and maybe I wish
bad
I weren't.
Conversation or something. I don't know.
So not boring would be an interesting one. You know what I mean?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Go. Six signs you're introverted,
not boring. Wow. Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. Keep an eye out.
Smash success.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier, like, the classic copywriting trick of it's not your fault. Mm-hmm. That's a clear case of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
it's
totally.
Not your fault. You're not lazy.
It's not your fault.
You're just burnt out.
Yes, it's not your fault. You know? This burned out happens to you. Lazy is something you choose and are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to be fair, like, the other thought with this that is worth, you know, audience, you're out if you're interested in YouTube. If not, this might not be as interesting. But you do have to ask yourself, are these the views that I want? I don't think that title is particularly horrible, but if you consistently tell people it's not your fault, it's not your fault, it's not your fault, you might get more views, make more sales, but you will wind up with people that probably think that things in their life that could reasonably be attributed to them and are their responsibility is somehow the world's foisted it upon them.
Yep.
So I do think that, and I wrote a rant on this way back in the day, that it's not your fault, while a very effective copywriting technique, is not something I like to throw around too much.
I love that article.
So here's the thing that I would do.
Should we link to it?
Because like
the description?
We might be able to find it. I mean, I was on a rant and I was a younger, more aggressive, sweary guy back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
But I was just like, it's your fault. It's all your fault. And what I meant is it's all your responsibility. Like this shirking of responsibility, the world did it to me. It's an old copywriter trick and I don't like it. I X'd it from the
I never want to perpetuate a victim mentality.
Yeah.
Even if shit happened to you. Mm-hmm. That sucks. Nothing's going to change if you just keep, you know, using that as a crutch.
Yeah.
Like, okay, acknowledge it. Yeah, things happened to you, you know, and we're all in an unequal world. But if you want things to change, you're going to have to shed that mentality and be like, cool, well, the only person who's going to dig me out is me. Mm-hmm. So if I were ever to use a title like that, six signs you're overwhelmed, not lazy.
Yeah.
My video's thesis would be, you chose to take on these, all these things. You chose to say yes, 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 yes. So what you need to learn is have the courage and the self-discipline to say no, to be able to let things go, and to understand what your limitations are. Mm-hmm. Not, oh, you're just overwhelmed, sorry.
Yeah, but that's a great lesson.
Yeah, it's a fantastic lesson, yeah. And this is, you know, this is the classic marketer moral, but I think effective and perhaps correct conundrum of selling what is desired, delivering what is needed, you know, like...
But that's not a lie. Sorry. Six signs you're overwhelmed, not lazy. And then telling them, here are the signs you're overwhelmed.
Yeah,
then at the end saying, by the way, the solution to being overwhelmed, this is on you. That's not
that's great.
Yeah, I think the video title is fine. It's just you never want the payoff to be still, yep, it's not your fault.
Yeah,
you're a victim. Feel good about the fact that it's not your fault. Like, I would never want that to be the conclusion.
Well, the good news is that nothing I say will convince a certain percentage of the population that it's not their height or genetics.
So, I think so. Let me.
There's literally some part of the audience that at every video is just commenting, well, yeah, but
so we're,
if
we're,
I had that face and the exact same personality, I would also be a movie star.
Well, I think we're talking about a very particular person who does not benefit and needs to shed victim mentality. Recently, I actually think there's pathological responsibility taking in like life in the world. And this has come from MDMA and those sorts of things. like, I think of the scene with Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting, where it's like, it's not your fault. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there's important moments to tell people and to feel that you didn't cause this. This is not your fault in a meaningful way. And I actually think the desire to not feel like a victim can become pathological because there are times when it's like appropriate to feel victimized can help you heal, move on, see the world as it truly is, get out of abusive relationships,
I think what Thomas was saying, correct me if I'm wrong, Thomas, it's not that it's not your fault in the sense that, like, listen, we're determinists to a large degree.
Yeah.
Like where you're at in life is because of your external circumstances and your genetic material. But it's in your hands now.
Responsibility versus fault. Yes.
So you were abused by your father, Good Will Hunting style. It's not your fault. You didn't earn that.
Mm-hmm.
He was an alcoholic. He had issues from his own trauma. You did not do anything to deserve that as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, you're 28 years old. You have to be the one to change your life, or else you are going to, and then whatever it is, be someone who isn't successful, or become an alcoholic, abuse your own kids. The onus is on you, even though all that horrible shit that set you back in life, that made it so that you didn't have pocket aces, you had a 3.8 off suit, that stuff wasn't your fault.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You had no control over it. You're not bad because of it. But now you are where you are today, and if you want that to change, take the reins.
It may not be your fault.
Yes.
It is your responsibility.
Yes. When I was a kid, sixth grade year of school was the worst. I was bullied horribly, like gangs of kids in the hallway just messing with me. And I was awkward.
Gangs of kids?
Like you know, 10, 12 kids shoved me into a locker.
No like, freaking way.
Teachers doing nothing. Nothing.
Where? What?
And this is like suburban Iowa. Like not...
Oh my gosh.
Why do you think Thomas lifts weights so hard?
there was definitely, my dad was like the ultimate man's man. He's like, my kids are going to be strong and know how to box and wrestle and everything. So like, I was forced to do every kind of fighting thing you could think of. But I was like a little bit awkward, a little bit hyperactive, but obviously did not deserve to be physically bullied, emotionally bullied by many people. Like, I was abused by those kids. My parents told me the teachers are doing nothing. And even though the teachers do something, those kids are never going to respect you because teachers did something. You have to do something. So the next time that guy picks on you and challenges you to a fight, you need to accept and do something about it. Wow. Now, I don't know if that's always the right answer for every person because somebody could be seriously hurt. But the fact of the matter is, just saying, yes, I'm abused, and then continuing to take it would have not done anything for me.
Sure.
There's also, and this is why it's always so hard to answer questions when people ask them from the audience. It's like, there's also neighborhoods where standing up for yourself like that might get you killed.
That's what I'm saying, right? Like, it worked out for me at that point, but it could have also not. But I guess and this is a particularly risky situation because we're talking about like using violence to solve your problems. Mm-hmm. But I guess the crux of it is I acknowledge that I have done nothing that is deserving of this bad situation. The world is bad to me right now. Mm-hmm. But if I want to get out of it, I have to do something.
Sure.
Well, this is just also to be clear, this is super generational because we're all sitting here in our 30s and we all have that mindset, but that's not how younger people feel at all. Younger people think that the government should step in.
Well, mom did come in, apparently, they say, with the helicopter generation. I wasn't really
there. Well, I'm saying forgetting even, like for that story, there a lot of people would say, nope, that the society should be protecting you. Security guards should be there. Teachers should be reprimanding them in such a way that you don't have to even be in that situation. The government should give you minimum wage and healthcare, and
they weren't going to do that.
No, but they're saying there's there's two at odds arguments.
Yeah,
and I think both have valid points. One is the system is broken if that's the case, and instead of telling every kid
learn to karate,
punch your bullies.
Yeah,
we need a better system that
protects,
makes
kids
sure
from
that
bullies,
no one in schools.
Yep.
Has any threat of physical violence, and no matter what the neighborhood is, no matter what the income level is, we need a system of safety.
I think
in public
schools. Both points are valid.
That's what I'm saying.
Like we would all love a Star Trek civilization where there's, it's post scarcity, everything's fine.
Yeah,
but we don't have that, so we need to strive for systemic changes. But in the same time, we have to acknowledge that right now those changes cannot be enacted fast enough. So there are things that we have to do personally. And maybe the right answer in that situation was, I'm being viciously bullied and the teachers will do nothing, so I need to remove myself from the situation. Mm-hmm. Like in a perfect world, I would have just gone to a different school or something.
Your mindset here is going to dictate how you think things should be handled. Because let's say that you are let's say you have a job you don't like and you feel underpaid. You're going to quit and start your own business or start your own side hustle and work 100 hours a week. If you have the onus of responsibility falls on me, you're going to unionize or maybe picket outside of government officials or whatever if you think that the answer is new legislation, right? Yeah. In either case, you can be active, but how you believe the solution comes about is going to determine what action.
Yeah.
So yeah, we are all of the mindset of quit and start your own business, do your own thing, take your own responsibility, obviously, but that's actually, I think, going out of style. I think the more popular mindset today is, no, there should be the systemic change where no one has to dislike their job and no one has to, there is no job on the planet that pays less than 80 grand a year. And we do this all from the governmental level. I think that's much more common in
I'm unsure if younger it's more people. Common or if it's just that negativity bias plus social media, the way it is, makes it easy for anybody who has any point of view to see the opposing point of view they hate and think, oh, okay, this is how people think.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I saw Andrew Yang and Bernie Sanders and AOC talk about this stuff, and none of them won presidency yet, but I think there's increasingly, it seems, support for politicians that are in that camp. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's just what makes me think that that movement is swelling.
Yeah.
I guess as far as I remember, you didn't have representatives like that in politics as much who were arguing for that kind of legislation. But yeah. I could be wrong. I mean, I'm only 34. Maybe this was happening in the 80s.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Who knows? Anything else?
Nope.
Let's do it, dude. Thank you for coming. Did you want to talk about anything before we sign off?
No, I'm good.
Go to Thomas's channel if you want to learn about Notion. We didn't even mention really the word Notion. That's like your baby.
I know. I asked Tom. I said before we go on, is there anything you want to talk about? And he's like, not really.
Thomas is super into productivity, organization, and as his like primary tool, he's been all over the place, has landed on Notion. Mm-hmm. He's shown me this kind of stuff, and for me, this is so far afield of anything that I ever do.
Well, let's say this. Let's say who's...
But who is it?
Start for the channel. Forget that. I think the Notion product is something people can find through the channel, but your YouTube channel.
Yeah. Well, my YouTube channel.
What age, what path interest, in life? Yeah. Like, yeah, who's that for?
I am trying to connect with people who are maybe a few years younger than I am. So
mid-20s.
Yep. Earlier on in my channel's history, was very much like, here's how to be good at school. And now it's like, here's how to be good at adult life.
Mm-hmm. And what channel. Does that mean? I'm trying to be more productive, so more
productive, be
wealthy.
More organized, you know, optimize your sleep and health habits. And then I'm working on like investing content. I'm buying a house right now. So I'm documenting the things I do there, the decisions I make, the math behind decisions I make.
Okay. So if you're a 20-year-old optimizer, that's who you would say your channel's
for.
Yeah,
there you go. Yeah, okay.
If you're a 20-year-old optimizer,
optimize your life.
There you go. Go find Thomas's YouTube channel. What's it called these days?
It's just Thomas Frank.
Okay.
And then if people want to learn about Notion, Thomas Frank Explains is the second channel.
Cool.
Why pay more for a separate CoQ10 supplement? Enjoy twice the benefits with SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced. From the number one doctor, pharmacist, and cardiologist recommended beet brand for heart health support, the new SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced by Human is now infused with CoQ10. That's essentially like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 ingredients support nitric oxide production, healthy blood pressure, healthy CoQ10 levels, and heart-healthy energy with two tasty chews a day. Plus, SuperBeats Heart Chews Advance are plant-based, so you get heart-healthy energy without stimulants. For a limited time, get a free 30-day supply of SuperBeats Heart Chews on all bundles and 15% off your first order by going to RadioBeats.com and using promo code DEAL. That's RadioBeats.com, code DEAL.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.